invite Jeremy Foster forward to speak to us on his subject, Signs and Symbols in the Bible.
Well, good evening. Tonight, we have a big subject, signs and symbols in the Bible. There's plenty of signs, plenty of symbols. We're going to try to focus on just a handful, those that are found here in 2 Peter chapter 3. So that's our goal. We'll see how good we are at keeping to that. And with this goal, the reality is we want to become individuals when we read the Bible, that we immediately grasp the concepts, and we're not lost in the details. We're not questioning some of the core components found within the reading. You know, it's pretty common nowadays, if you read any novels or enjoy that kind of thing, that the novels that do really well, they're written in such a way that they have various points made, expressions, language that captures your attention, but you find it throughout the book. And, they could, just give you a bunch of bullet points and tell you everything, but that's not what makes a novel interesting. It's about finding those threads and these common themes and the deeper meaning, right? And so the Bible's no different in that respect. So we read 2 Peter chapter 3, and I just want to highlight, this isn't one of the symbols or the signs or the phrases we want to look up, but I think it's something that most of, in the room especially would appreciate. It talks about the last days, the day of judgment, the day of the Lord, and the day of God. And so for anyone who reads the Bible, I mean, immediately that draws attention. We're talking about the time of, the end, this big moment in history, right? When God does something big. And the question is, what does he do? And what are the other symbols? How do they play a part in understanding of this particular prophecy by Peter? So, if you go to Wikipedia, and Wikipedia is great because, it's common knowledge, common shared knowledge. And so you can even go and update Wikipedia if you'd like yourself. And so it provides sort of a basis of, at least to a certain extent, a large subset of people on what they believe something means or whatnot. So, the very basic structure, a symbol is a mark, a sign, a word that indicates, signifies, or understands, is understood as representing an idea, object, or relationship. And symbols allow people to go beyond what is known or seen by creating linkages between otherwise very different concepts and experiences. And so this is the purpose of signs and symbols. You ask, why doesn't God just explain things to us in a really simple format? Why doesn't he provide that? Well, if you go and read children books, you just open up any child book, you'll find signs and symbols. It's the most basic structure for teaching children. In fact, if you drive down the road, what will you find on a regular basis? Signs and symbols, they're all short form. They're to capture your attention, express an idea, so that you understand what needs to happen while you're driving. And so, throughout our lives, signs and symbols play a very strong and prominent role in our understanding in how to live our lives. And so the Bible, once again, does the same thing. There's this common misconception about the Bible, more specifically about biblical symbolism. More often than not, the general impression people have is that biblical symbolism is cryptic or mystical, right? And this continues to propagate the impression that they are mysterious, full of mystery, and as such remain a mystery. And the result of this conclusion is that interpreting the Bible, and specifically symbolism, is either a cryptic art form and or one which leads to a different interpretation for each person. So that's the result of that thought process, even though we don't use that thought process in our day-to-day lives or when we're reading novels or anything, right? Symbols are everywhere in modern society, from emojis, for those that are really cool and love to type on their phones, advertising to religious symbols, road signs, and these markings provide us with context, directions, and meanings. But what benefit do these, you know, and this is actually a quote from Fiona MacDonald from Science Alert, and she's saying, what benefit? And she's looking at historical symbolism, you know, stuff you find in caves, you know, art. It says, but what benefit did these drawings have? This allowed humans to communicate vast amounts of information efficiently, let the marketplaces that were abundant with food and water sources, helping to pass on valuable, life-saving information to their families. Isn't that incredible? Is that what we think of when we see cave drawings, right? And yet they had an important role in the society of the time to educate, to train, to teach. And so once again, the Bible is no different. So now we're going to look at some signs. And this is somewhat interactive. It's not overly complicated. And I just want to put the impression, these are imageries, but they use words as well. And they're supposed to convey a specific idea and concept in our mind. And we shouldn't be confused by these, all right? So let's do the first one. This one's pretty recent news. All right, so this is very common. What happens in especially modern days, and I don't think this is new. In fact, I'll discuss one in the Bible quick. Brexit. What is that word made out of? Two words.
Britain and Exit.
Britain and Exit. Okay, so this is very common nowadays. Everybody loves putting two words together. You know, they get two celebrities, they put their names together because now it's cool. That's what they do. Because they want to capture as much information as possible in a single idea, concept, word, right? And so we know right away, this already happened, this is old news. Britain is on its way from leaving the European Union. At least they voted, and we know there's complications and delays and all this other complexity to it. But regardless, this captures our attention. We know what it is. It's pretty simple. It's the flag of Britain with a keyword. You know, the Bible does that too. It uses keywords in the days that it was provided that people could look around, like, say, Babylon, and they could see all the symbology around them. They could see dragons with people's heads on them, and they could see, lions and all these different imageries, you know, these statues. And yet the Bible was using the same language to capture those ideas and those concepts so people could understand them. Here's another one. It's, recent news, but old news. Hillary's lies matter. All right? And no doubt it had an impact on the election, as we know. And what is it playing on? Black Lives Matter. All right? So, the world is full of the imagery, and sometimes we don't get it. Most times, I think, especially when it's these kind of simple things, we get it, and we realize, oh, yeah, we understand. Right? And so the world is trying to teach us something very basic, is that we can understand symbols and signs. Look at these ones. So for those that don't know, American politics is made of two animals. They're represented by two symbols. You have the Democrats and the other guys, the Republic, right? So you have the donkey and the elephant down there. So anytime you see those images, you know what it's talking about when it's dealing with American politics. And this, you know, it's funny. It's talking about the deficit and money problems, and just uses large animals to express that. And we get a chuckle out of it. You know, the Bible does the same thing. It uses animals to express certain problems, right? In human nature, it expresses as an animal. And so you have this, humorous language. So you might say, well, this is all just, it's kind of like news items and whatnot. It doesn't really affect our day-to-day life or our overall structure of government and whatnot. Well, I've shown this one before, but if you don't think Bible imagery plays a huge role in man's thinking today and governments and establishment, you just have to look at stuff like this. All right? So this is the European Union Parliament building, and they've based it on the art form of the Tower of Babel. Right? The guy who designed this didn't say, out of the blue, I like circles and I like incomplete sections. He didn't do that. He had a rich understanding of symbology and the importance it plays and the ideas and the concepts of what is being trying to achieve oneness with a bunch of people that speak different languages, right? That's what he's trying to accomplish. So it's very fitting. But of course, when you're a Bible student, you go, yeah, it's really fitting, but for different reasons. But we want to go beyond just pictures and imagery, because the Word of God actually goes one step further, right? And it's trying to express that word imagery is more powerful than imagery. So a picture, you know, a picture's worth a thousand words. Well, if you use the right words, it develops a picture in your mind that is far greater. And so the power of words is that you choose the right word, and there's sayings, right? The power of the pen is greater than the sword. It's trying to tell us that we can be educated in such a way we can be inclined to know what even the future is if we understand these words. And I found this fascinating. If you go on the internet and you just, you know, you type in some words and you're just looking for phrases and ideas, you go, powerful words, you know, because you want powerful words. And you just hope the search engine gives you something cool. And it's fascinating. It comes back with two most powerful words. Now, in the concept that the internet's trying to express right here is actually false, because it's all about me, right? I think, therefore I am. It's all about philosophy. But where do you find this phrase in the Bible? Everywhere. We've been doing our readings, many of us, day to day, Isaiah, I am the Lord, I do this, I will do that. Right? This is a powerful phrase. So if we understand word imagery, it has an impact on the way we think. So symbolism is a visual language. It's trying to capture our attention, have these images come into our heads so that we read the word, we get a good picture of what the word is, we understand what it's trying to accomplish, and we're not confused by it. So we read 2 Peter chapter 3, and there's phrases in there, and I tell you right now, you go at this door and you ask someone in another religious group to read those words, they'll come to a different conclusion than what we will tonight. All right? It's all because not understanding signs and symbols. All right, so let's look at some of the signs and symbols. And first of all, we're setting the tone, right? We're going through this quick. We're going to look at heaven, earth, and seas, all right, or water. Those are the signs and symbols we're going to look at, trying to understand where the Bible's coming at so that we can understand 2 Peter chapter 3. Because there's implication when we understand it, one way or the other. If we understand it wrong, we come to a conclusion that's wrong, and therefore all of our hopes for the future are wrong. If we understand the phrases, we understand the signs and symbols, we read it, we understand it, and we have a hope for something that is correct, if we have it right, right? So, first of all, let's set the tone. The way the Bible uses these phrases is not different than the way the world uses these phrases, all right? So it's not like, it's a different language and you got to just totally turn off your way of thinking and just come up with some new plan. This is the same stuff that happens if you read a book. Look at this, heaven. So the politics of heaven, that's what the book title is. Right? So is it a religious book? An unsettling account of events, ideas, and minds behind the nameless political movements that govern America today. You see it? I mean, it's really basic, right? Like we get lost in these signs and symbols. You start reading Revelation, boy, oh boy, you're talking about a lot of heavens going on and a lot of different signs and symbols, and you get confused. And there, no doubt, just because there's just the bombarding us with symbols. It's just too many at a time. But Peter doesn't do that. Peter is just a handful of symbols. He uses heaven, earth, and the seas and waters, and it's in the context of the last days, right? When Jesus Christ is going to set up the kingdom, whatever that means. Another book, just in case you thought that book was just a lucky draw, The New American Magazine in 1853. So this is old hat for all you elderly. If you're around then, you could, say, yeah, I read that. I hadn't. I just searched for it. We do not believe the threatening aspects of the European heavens would have been what they are now had England, from the first, presented a bold front and denounced war upon the brazen-faced aggressors. So, I mean, once again, it's silly, but I'm trying to emphasize. They understood these words, these terms. This is not new hat. And I thought this was neat, because this expands and tries to express. It's not just the word heaven. It's the concept, right? Another book, Birth of the German Republic. and again, it's an older book, the pages in which German constitutional growth for the past two generations is reviewed give ample evidence as to why the word constellation is so often employed in reference to political situations in Germany. And it goes blah, 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 blah. And in 1932, as those of the period it was written to cover, is that no German constitution has ever succeeded in grouping all the powerful elements in the German state. Bismarck's constellation had as its principal triad the army. And it continues on, talks about other constellations, the political heavens, these double stars. And you know what's so fascinating about this book? It was all before the European Union. It's saying all these attempts to bring all these nations together have failed. And now they're doing it, European Union, right? And this is another topic for another night. But I find it fascinating to use a language that we'd understand when we're reading our Bible, when it's talking about heavens, the constellations, the stars, the moons. We're talking about these political, national elements, right, in the world. That's how they use it. We'll have to see if it's true in the Bible. Earth. Let's see what it talks about in the earth. Another book. It's called The Land. And this book's just a novel. All right, so this isn't some historical element or, you know, a lesson in national politics. But I found it fascinating because it shows you that this is very common understanding. The novel centers around the land more than anything, as indicated by the title. Wang Lung feels deeply connected to the earth, and it symbolizes the life in all its forms. As Wang's life... Lung's life literally depends on it. He builds his house out of the earth, grows his food in it, even eats the dirt itself when his family is starving. He feels that the earth is part of him and he a part of it. That shouldn't come new to us. And when his family members die, he's comforted by the fact that they can lie in the earth. The land acts as an antithesis or an opposing force to the detrimental effects of wealth. Only poorer people work on the land. And it's seen as improper for Wang Lung's family to do so once they become wealthy. So I find that fascinating. You know, these concepts of using these words and these phrases, these symbolic language, is common. It's not something new. So he uses the earth as a representation of the base people, not the heavens, not the leaders, not the rich. Right? And well, just an offshoot, these ones are nice and easy. Still not convinced we use signs and symbols in our everyday, you know, affairs. Every single flag for every single nation, and I don't think you can be a nation without a flag, I think it's part of the charter, you get to choose your symbols. Right? You got the lovely stars, you got some stripes for the Americans, they represent the states and the British colonies. Then you got the sun, Japan, right? They're the like most easterly on their continent. They get to see the sun first. You have Turkey, the moon, and the star. And interesting enough, if you're in certain places, you'll find on top of generally Greek Orthodox, on top of their temples, they have a pole with on top the cross. And underneath, does anybody know what's up underneath? It's a crescent. Right? Now, you know, you don't have to take my word for it, but the Greek Orthodox have a pretty big bone to pick with the Turks because they pushed them out of, you know, Asia Minor, and which is now Turkey. And so it highlights Christianity over Islam, right? So, you know, the symbols are all around us. And last, of course, the European Union, you get 12 stars. So we're rich with symbols. We already seen the European Union, its connection with the Tower of Babel. This is old hat. All right, so we're in Peter, and this is the section we had to read. So we just want to highlight, we're dealing with the promise of his coming. Who's his? Jesus Christ, right? So the promise of Jesus Christ coming, and this is the hope of the Bible, right? It's telling us we are anticipating Jesus Christ. Acts chapter 2, you know, Acts chapter 1, he ascends up to heaven, and he says, I'll come, return in like manner, right? So this is the foundational hope, one of the foundational hopes of Christians, Bible students, that Christ would return and set up the kingdom. And from the beginning, creation. So he's saying this particular hope began way back before Acts, right? Before Christ ascended to heaven. This is a hope that has been established in the text. By the word of God, the heavens were of old, the earth standing out of the water, and in the water he's talking about these literal elements, but the heavens and the earth, which are now, by the same word, are kept in store. And so he's going to mix this language, and this is what's difficult for many of us. We read that he's talking about the creative account. So we're thinking literal earth, literal heavens, right? And they're kept in store, reserved, he says, unto fire against the day of judgment. So that sounds bad. And the perdition of ungodly men. But the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens shall pass away with a great noise, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. So again, pretty bad news for the heaven and earth. If we continue with the basic understanding, we're talking about the creative elements around us. And the works that are therein shall be burned up, looking for and hasting unto the coming of the day of God, wherein the heavens being on fire, again, pretty bad, shall be dissolved, and the elements shall melt with a fervent heat. Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for a new heavens, new earth, wherein dwelleth righteousness. So regardless of how you want to interpret that, we're understanding that there's a destruction of the old and a creation of the new, right? So it doesn't matter how you take that. I mean, there's a pretty clear-cut line. There's a destruction, and there's a creation. So now we have to understand how do we interpret these things? How do we come to the conclusion? What is our hope? Are we looking forward to a lot of fire, brimstone, burning? Or are we looking forward to something else? So that's the context of this study. So let's begin. Let's start digging into our Bible, and we'll just look at a few of these. Let's go to Psalm 32, verse 6. So this is where you all get to do some work. So the Bible uses symbology throughout, and it doesn't leave us guessing. We just have to go to, you know, a handful of verses to start seeing context and ideas. Psalm 32, verse 6, "For this shall every one that is godly pray unto thee in a time when thou mayest be found. Surely in the floods of great waters they shall not come nigh unto him." So we're not reading, you know, use your eyes, view the verses around it. We don't have time to look at it all. But the psalmist here is essentially saying he's in a tough point in life, right? He's being surrounded by waters, and God is saying he'll protect him from those waters. If you go to Psalm 69, in verse 1 and 2, "Save me, O God, for the waters are come in unto my soul. I sink in deep mire where there is no standing. I am come into deep waters where the floods overflow me." And once again, the psalmist is expressing his challenges in life. And does anybody want to hazard a guess what the challenges in life were? In a generic sense. I mean, they had specific challenges, but if you're going to just interpret based on reading a couple of verses, what is he complaining? Is he talking about that he's you know, stuck in a river and the waters are going to run him over? No, not literally, right? He's using symbolic language. He's using eloquent language. And he's expressing, in a generic sense, the trials of people trying to kill him, right? Go to Isaiah 43. Isaiah 43, verse 2. It's interesting because it's actually the language that if we're, you know, keeping our eyes on signs and symbols, we find that we're not going to turn up the Mark 9 one, but I'll just highlight what that is in a second. "When thou passest through the waters, I'll be with thee, and through the rivers they shall not overflow thee. When thou walkest through the fire, thou shalt not be burned, neither shall the flame kindle upon thee." And so once again, you know, definitely there's a, you know, a literal aspect, especially when we understand Bible stories and how they were able to walk through the Red Sea and the River Jordan, and you know, Daniel's three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, were thrown in the furnace and they weren't burnt. There's definitely literal aspects to this, right? But that's not what Isaiah here is talking about. He's talking about the judgments or the trials of Israel as a whole, Israel and Judah, because of the nations around, the oppression that they would face, right? Now, in Mark 9, chapter 22, picks up on two of these symbols. We don't have to go there. It talks about a son who had a dumb spirit, it says in the King James, that would throw him into the waters, into the fire. And the disciples couldn't heal him. And Christ says, how long shall I be with this faithless generation? And he heals him. And so once again, you can, if you fall on signs and symbols and you're going through the Bible, it gets richer, right? You start to see connections. What is God trying to tell us about that particular scenario? But we're not going there right now. Go to Ephesians chapter 5. So we all know symbols and phrases, they can be used in a multitude of different ways. But we're interested in finding an interpretation that makes sense, right? And if we have 10 different interpretations, that makes it a challenge. So Ephesians 5, verse 26. That he might sanctify and cleanse it with the washing of water by the word. And so you see this instant connection with the idea of the word and water and this other idea of being cleansed. In Isaiah chapter 55 and verse 10 to 11, one thing that you will find, if you, especially when it comes to the 2 Peter chapter 3, when it talks about the heavens and earth and the seas, the waters, Isaiah is the template for understanding those particular symbols. So Isaiah chapter 55, verse 10 to 11. For as the rain cometh down, and the snow from heaven, and returneth not thither, but watereth the earth, and maketh it bring forth bud, and it may give seed to the sower, and bread to the eater, so shall my word be that goeth forth out of my mouth. So he's drawing these connections, these concepts, these ideas, and we're not supposed to get lost in the details. We get these different ideas and concepts, but there's actually a theme. There's a consistency with these phrases. Now, we don't want to look at salvation, eternal life. I just want to put them in cleansing, put them in there. There's some incredible points out of those. But just to highlight that when we're doing it, we're trying to be good Bible students, trying to understand signs and symbols. They will be used in different ways. But what we want to see is if there's something that is consistent in its use, and specifically can be applied to the context we're reading. So go to Isaiah chapter 8. In Isaiah chapter 8, verse 7 to 8, now therefore, behold, the Lord bringeth up upon them the waters of the river, strong and many. So he's talking about rivers and waters. And here he gives the answer. And this is what's lovely about Isaiah. It often gives us the answer in the same verse or in a verse very close to it. Even the king of Assyria and all his glory, and he shall come up over all his channels and go over all his banks. And he shall pass through Judah. He shall overflow and go over. He shall reach even to the neck, and the stretching out of his wings shall fill the breadth of the land, O Emmanuel. So, you know, it doesn't take a lot of effort here to understand the language of the rivers overflowing is the concept of the Assyrian Empire expanding its borders and conquering Judah, specifically reaching into Judah. We know it didn't conquer it, but it did conquer Israel. So the 10 tribes were taken away and ceased to exist. You continue in Isaiah chapter 17 there. So this isn't a singular idea or concept. In Isaiah 17, verse 12 to 13, woe to the multitude of many people which make a noise like the noise of the seas, and to the rushing of nations that make a rushing like the rushing of mighty waters. The nations shall rush like the rushing of many waters, but God shall rebuke them, and they shall flee far off, and shall be chased as the chaff of the mountain before the wind. So here you have this continual concept, and you could look at these other passages, where God's trying to express national identities and their movement as waters, rivers, and seas, if we continue on. So we have these meanings, these words, these symbols, and you go, too many meanings, it's not helpful. How can we know which meaning to use? First of all, was it difficult to interpret the meanings thus far? Was, each time we read those passages, was it really cryptic to understanding the meaning? I don't think so. I tried to pick the ones that pretty much in the same verse gave the answer. And so you can see there's an easy way to interpret these, right? So each provides enough context, but we really haven't looked at the difficult passages, right? And 2 Peter chapter 3 is somewhat difficult because it talks about the creative account. So, you know, it seems to be talking about the literal earth, literal heavens. So let's look at a few more. Let's look at the earth. We won't look at the first thing, but the earth is connected to natural things, natural thinking, the flesh, right? In James 3, verse 15, and Philippians 3, verse 19. But in Ecclesiastes, we read that it's about the lifespan of an individual. So just go to that one, Ecclesiastes chapter 3. And verse 20. All go into one place, all are of the dust, and all turn to dust again. So that's something, you know, we're pretty familiar with. So the earth is related to our lives, lifespan. Well, in Genesis chapter 6, verse 12 to 13, we see immediately in the Bible this connection, this association with people and the earth. So Genesis 6, verse 12, and God looked upon the earth, and behold, it was corrupt. Was the earth corrupt? No, right? I mean, the earth is the earth. Unless you believe in Gaia, right? Or Gia, I don't know how to pronounce it. I think it's Gaia. So unless you have a different understanding of what the Bible is trying to teach about the earth is obviously not what's corrupt. In fact, if there was any question, it says, for all flesh had corrupted its way upon the earth, right? So it answers the interpretation. And God said unto Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth. And so the earth is strongly associated with the people that dwell upon it. And in Psalm 148, in verse 11, we see that kings of the earth and all the people, princes and all judges of the earth. And so what you have is kings rule over the earth. Judges rule over the people. Right? You have these two layers. So the people, just like that book using the earth, those, you know, the people that weren't wealthy, they have to toil in the earth. That's what the earth is trying to represent to us. Well, not only that, if we go to, we won't turn to these ones, but it talks about the children of Israel in 1 Samuel 4, verse 5, Exodus 9, verse 29, and you can compare that with 2 Samuel 7, verse 23. It's talking about the children of Israel. But go to Isaiah chapter 24, and we'll see a strong connection to Israel and the earth. So Isaiah 24, verses 1 to 3. Behold, the Lord maketh the earth empty, and maketh it waste, and turneth it upside down, and scattereth abroad the inhabitants thereof. So he's talking about the whole earth. And it shall be as with the people, so with the priest, as with the servant, so with his master, as with the maid, so with her mistress, as with the buyer, so with the seller, as with the lender, so with the borrower, as with the taker, as the taker of usury, so with the giver of usury to him. The land shall be utterly emptied and utterly spoiled, for the Lord hath spoken his word. And what's this? Who's this chapter against? Anyone want to hazard a guess? It's talking about Israel, isn't it? Remember Isaiah? We'll go back to Isaiah chapter 1 soon enough. Isaiah is all about Israel, right? And also the nations surrounding Israel. So right here we see the earth is connected to Israel and specifically the people in it, right? You can look at Isaiah chapter verse 14 to 15 there, sorry, and Isaiah 33, verse 9, and also in James 5, verse 17. But go to now Isaiah chapter 34, verse 1 to 2. So the earth isn't just limited to Israel. But remember, the scripture puts a lot of emphasis with Israel and the earth. So there's a strong connection there that we shouldn't neglect. But it's also talking about the people around. Come near, ye nations, to hear, and hearken, ye people. Let the earth hear, and all that is therein, the world, and all things that come forth of it. For the indignation of the Lord is upon all nations, and his fury upon all their armies. He hath utterly destroyed them. He hath delivered them to the slaughter. So God is trying to express the concepts of nations as a geographical element of the earth. Like they're connected to this creative account. They're part of this earth. You know, dust we are and dust we shall return. And so there shouldn't be a disassociation with the earth and with the people. So when we go to 2 Peter chapter 3, and we'll get there again, there shouldn't be a separation in our minds if we're trying to understand symbols and signs between the earth and the people and the heavens with the leaders. So far, right? So water and earth, how are they used together? Well, in Genesis chapter 1, verse 9 to 10, it gives us this incredible account. We don't have time to look at the creative account and see how all these symbols play out because it's fascinating, but it's just not part. We don't have enough time. It tells us that the seas were separated and the dry land appeared, right? So you have this imagery of something coming out of the water, dry land. And the result of that dry land coming out is it becomes fruitful, trees and vegetation grows. And also, it's on the third day, side point. We're told in Jeremiah 5, verse 22, that God has set the bounds of the seas. It says he's made it so they can't pass over the sand. So he's adjusted all these seas so that they're in their place. And Daniel chapter 4, verse 32, it tells us, and what's interesting about Daniel chapter 4 is that the king of Babylon wrote this, it's his dialogue. In Daniel 4, verse 32, and they shall drive thee from men, and thy dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field, that they may make thee eat grass as oxen, and seven times shall pass over thee, until thou know that the Most High ruleth in the kingdom of men, and giveth it to whomsoever he will. And what we're trying to is, it was word imagery, that God has set the bounds of the seas and the earth. He set the bounds of the nations. He understands their structure, and he's telling, you know, us that these imagery, this imagery of the seas and earth, is an expression of nations against nations, specific nations that has been brought out of the sea. In Exodus chapter 14, you have this beautiful language of Israel leaving Egypt. We don't want to read this whole section, but Moses stretched his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided. And the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea upon the dry ground, and the waters were a wall unto them on the left hand and on the right. And as they passed through, the Egyptians, so that nation was trying to crush Israel, they pursued after, and the waves came in and destroyed them. So you have this, the same themes, right? God has set the bounds of nations. He's made it so that they can go no further, and he's raised up this place, dry land, in which he wants to make fertile. Go to Luke chapter 8, verse 3. So once again, this is a fascinating little connection. We don't have time to do it justice. But in Luke 8, verse 33, we're told about this individual named Legion. Then went the devils out of the man and entered into the swine, and the herd ran violent down a steep place into the lake and were choked. Right? And you go, why is that little detail there? Well, go to Micah chapter 7, verse 19. So again, another symbol we don't have time to look at, pigs in general, talking about unclean things, and regrettably, it's talking about Gentile nations. That's a connection. You have to believe me, because we're not spending any time on it. Micah 7, verse 19. He will turn again. He will have compassion upon us. He will subdue our iniquities, and thou wilt cast all their sins into the depths of the sea. So, when you start to look at these concepts, this idea of water and earth, there's this lesson being taught, is that getting cast into the sea is a bad thing, but being taken out of the sea is a good thing. And what does Jesus Christ call his disciples to do? They become fishers of men, to cast their net and to draw in fish, right? So again, more symbols. But we're not confused by those ideas, those concepts. And so this basic imagery that God's trying to express to us with heaven and earth and waters and seas is this language or this theme of people being drawn out, this creative account of God bringing people out of the nations into a dry land that's going to become fruitful. All right. And the last, we won't look at the Babylon one, but look at Isaiah chapter 1, because this is the kingmaker, I believe. So Isaiah chapter 1, verses 1 to 4. The vision of Isaiah, the son of Amos, which he saw concerning, what's the subject? Judah and Jerusalem. In the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, Hezekiah, kings of Judah. Hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth. Is he talking to inanimate objects? Is he just yelling up at the sky? No. See? The signs and symbols are there. We don't have to read very hard to understand them. He's talking about Judah and Jerusalem. He's talking about the nation of Israel. And he talks about how he has nourished them up as children, and yet they've rebelled against him. So he's trying to bring out of Egypt, right, out of the nations, this people that he's trying to call his own. He says, the ox knoweth his owner, and the ass his master's crib, but Israel doth not know, my people doth not consider a sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a seed of evildoers, children that are corruptors. They have forsaken the Lord, they have provoked the Holy One of Israel unto anger, they are gone away backward. Does it remind you anything in 2 Peter? Anything? About these last days and how God is fed up with them. Scoffers, mockers. And in verse 10 there, hear the word of the Lord. So is there any doubt yet what heavens are talking about? Ye rulers of Sodom. Again, symbol, language, right? Trying to draw our attention to that concept. Give ear unto the law of our God, ye earth people of Gomorrah, right? So the language is consistent. It's trying to teach us some basic ideas that God is performing a creative work on people. And specifically, he's going to use a geographical area of Israel and the nations that surround it. And we'll fill the whole earth. So we have a challenge here, and I didn't do this as pretty as I was going to do. I was going to make it so you could only read the second part first, and then I'd pull up the top part. But for sake of time, I thought this would be quicker. So Jesus gives this prophecy, Mount of Olivet, and, you know, it's a stumper. What is he talking about? He says, and there shall be signs in the sun, the moon, the stars, and upon the earth, distress of, and he gives an idea, distress of nations with perplexity, the sea and the waves roaring, men's hearts failing them for fear and for looking after those things which are coming upon the earth, for the powers of heaven shall be shaken. So very similar to 2 Peter chapter 3, isn't it? Right? Well, Luke chapter 21, same chapter, if you read verse 24, the verse before, it says, and they shall fall by the edge of the sword, and they shall be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem shall be trodden down of the Gentiles, until the time of the Gentiles be fulfilled. So the context and understanding those signs and symbols is to do with Israel. So once again, the challenge, and don't look at the first three verses there, just look at the second bit of Joel. And I'll show wonders in heaven and the earth, blood and fire, pillars of smoke. Sounds familiar, 2 Peter? The sun shall be turned into darkness, the moon into blood, and a great and terrible day of the Lord come. And it shall come to pass, and it actually tells us the answer at the end here, that whosoever shall call on the name of the Lord shall be delivered. For in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem shall be deliverance, as the Lord hath said, and in the remnant whom the Lord shall call. But you know, the chapter began with a context. Blow ye the trumpet in Zion, and sound an alarm in my holy mountain. Let all the inhabitants of the land tremble. And it continues on, and it talks about this wonderful time of the kingdom to come. But for that kingdom to come, these incredible signs and symbols must occur, this destructive event. In Isaiah chapter 65, it uses the exact same language in 2 Peter chapter 3. And what was Isaiah chapter 1 talking about when it talked about the heavens and the earth? We just read it. Give ear, Judah, Jerusalem, rulers of Sodom, people of Gomorrah. In Isaiah chapter 65, he says, for behold, I create new heavens and a new earth. And the former shall not be remembered nor come into mind, but be ye glad and rejoice forever in that which I create. For behold, I create Jerusalem, a rejoicing. Is Jerusalem a place of rejoicing today in the nations around? No, it's a bitter spot, right? It's the thorn in everybody's foot. And her people joy. How many people know lots of Jew lovers, right? You know, I've actually worked in a Jewish-owned company, and they had employees that didn't realize they had a certain misgiving against Jews. It's common that the Jews are a problem. Israel's a problem. Jerusalem's a problem, right? And this verse is telling us a new heavens, new earth, that's going to change that opinion. And the voice of weeping shall no more be heard in her, nor the voice of crying. There shall be no more thence an infant of days, nor an old man that hath not filled his days. For the child shall die 100 years old. So he's saying, young people 100 years old. That's incredible. The sinner, being 100 year old, shall be accursed. And they shall build houses and inhabit them. They shall plant vineyards and eat the fruit thereof. They shall not build and another inhabit. They shall not plant, another eat. For as the days of a tree are the days of my people, and my elect shall long enjoy the work of their hands. They shall not labor in vain, nor bring forth for trouble. For they are the seed of the blessed of the Lord, and their offspring with them. And it shall come to pass that before they call, I will answer. And while they are yet speaking, I will hear. The wolf and the lamb shall feed together, and the lion shall eat straw like the bullock, and the dust shall be the serpent's meat. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, saith the Lord. Isn't that fascinating? So God's made this promise. He's going to change the heavens and the earth. Specifically, it begins with the change of Israel. We know Israel, based on chapter 1 of Isaiah, were a horrible nation, right? But God's going to change that. And when you're reading through this, and you read those animals at the end, there's probably a little aspect of them, but there's a very good chance he's talking about the nations around, right? So we get back to Peter, and we want to conclude. This is about the promise of Christ's coming. And he's talking about a new Jerusalem, a new world order, a new king, a new political system. This is what he's talking about. It's a new heavens, a new earth. He's not talking about the destruction of the what's underneath our feet and the stars falling and everything burning up. He's talking about a creative process of changing the world and filling it with his righteousness. So look at this. Heavens, earth, waters. We're talking about the leadership in the nations, the people in the nations and the people in them. And specifically all centered around the apple of his eye, Israel. Simon hath declared how God at the first did visit the Gentiles to take out of them a people for his name. That's the greater theme. That's what God's trying to accomplish with this creative account. He didn't create the earth so that it might not be inhabited. He created the earth to be inhabited, to be filled with life. In Hebrews 11, he looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God, but now they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly. whereof God is not ashamed to be called for their God, called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city. He's going to build New Jerusalem, a new heavens and a new earth. So what's the interpretation? Well, we have two major critical options. And if you read most literature outside of this room, you'll find this particular, what I would call, incorrect. God is going to destroy the earth, and the literal heavens where God dwells is the place of reward. Right? So you see, understanding these symbols, how impactful it is. So if you came into this room and you understood those symbols to represent heaven as in where God dwells only, and therefore that's where we're going, heaven bound, and all the doctrine that's associated with it, and earth, all bad, no, nothing good, it's just going to be destroyed. Your even concepts of how you tend to the earth and what you do changes. And yet Jesus says, blessed are the meek, they shall inherit the earth. So the correct interpretation, which I just can't fathom any other conclusion based on reading a handful of passages, and you can go find 100 more, God is going to destroy those nations that oppose him and set up a new worldwide kingdom ruled by his son in righteousness. And in 2 Peter chapter 1, same book that we were reading, right? Same letter, which we were trying to understand. Knowing this first, that no prophecy of the scripture is of any private interpretation. In other words, we don't all come to our own conclusion. It's not relativism. The Bible is telling us what it means. The Bible is full of signs and symbols throughout. The use of symbolism is part of every page, not just prophecy. We looked at a few of those tonight. This type of language provides deeper meaning and incredible connections to greater themes. The use of symbolism isn't limited to the Bible and prophecy. We use it and interact with symbols every day. It enriches our lives and provides depth to topics that might otherwise require books to explain. Understanding the signs and symbols within Scripture provides us a much richer experience when reading it and is instrumental, critical in the development of our faith, especially as the day of the Lord approaches.